Okay, well, welcome everyone to round two of our two-part session on the legacy of Michel Foucault's work. Today's program is going to be the same as yesterday's. Of course, if you weren't here, that doesn't really mean anything, so I'll quickly run over it for you. We're going to have a half-hour presentation followed by a question period. The first presentation is going to be done by Professor Magnusson. He will be speaking on Before Foucault, Skepticism, Relativism, and Modernity. After that, we'll have a question period, half-hour question period. If you would like to participate in this question period, if you're watching this from the live web broadcast, please submit your questions to ctheory@uvic.ca. That's C, the letter, theory@uvic.ca. And then that will be followed by a brief break, in which I'm told the snacks will be here, depending on the timing of the UVic food services. But if they're there, we'll eat then. If not, stay afterwards. We'll have a quick bite. Following the break, Professor Walker will be presenting on self-determinism and limits. And then that is it for today. So if we have the snacks, and then you're invited to stick around, mingle, and discuss the presentation. Oh, one more quick announcement. As I mentioned yesterday, issue two of the On Politics journal is out. I want to reiterate, it's on our new website, www.onpolitics.ca. And because all we know, an image is much more powerful. I brought it today with you to show what it is that I'm talking about. It is an actual journal, but I'm telling you about the electronic form, so check that out. All right, so without further ado, I'm going to pass it off to Professor Magnusson.
You need this one?
You want it? Wire it up.
I should perhaps preface this by saying that I'm going to come at Foucault rather indirectly, because my topic is really the intellectual milieu at the time of the reception of Foucault's work into English, and hence the peculiarities of the reaction to Foucault in the English-speaking world, and by extension, the dilemmas that we have now in trying to make sense of Foucault in relation to existing intellectual traditions. In 1972, the English National Theatre staged a play about philosophy, Jumpers, by Tom Stoppard. It was not a play about philosophy in the lay sense, but about academic philosophy, as it then was in Britain. The central character is a hapless philosopher named George Moore, who suffers, among other things, from sharing a name with a famous philosopher of the preceding generation. The fictional George Moore is struggling against the turn in academic philosophy that had begun on Stoppard's account about 40 years earlier. No doubt the book that the fictional Moore, as well as the playwright and many of his audience had in mind, was A.J. Ayer's Language, Truth, and Logic, which was first published in 1936 and had already gone through 11 printings by the time I got my copy in 1965. That little book was, in a sense, the primer of logical positivism. In it, Ayer thanks his immediate mentors, Bertrand Russell, Ludwig Wittgenstein, Gilbert Ryle, and Isaiah Berlin, and describes their work as the logical outcome of the writings of the great 18th century empiricists, George Berkeley and David Hume. Ayer gives even greater credit to the work of the so-called Vienna Circle, especially Moritz Schlick and Rudolf Carnap, to whom he attributes most of the original insights on which he builds in his own work. Ayer takes the view that all statements to which a truth value can be assigned are either analytical, true by virtue of the meaning of the terms involved, i.e. tautologically, or synthetic, which is to say, susceptible, at least in principle, to empirical verification. He dismisses statements that appear to be synthetic or factual statements, but that are not subject to verification, for instance, the claim that God exists, as metaphysical and hence literally nonsensical or meaningless. This is the way he treats moral judgments, or judgments about ultimate political values. For him, these judgments are just expressions of our emotions, not subject to verification in any way. One of the implications of this view is that moral and political philosophy are impossible. If we understand them to be activities that somehow generate, by a process of logical reasoning, the first principles on which we are supposed to act, or the procedures we are supposed to use in generating first principles. Philosophy, on this view, is a second-order activity whose main purpose is to clarify what people are doing when they are thinking about things. Philosophers are supposed to do this by resolving the muddles that we get ourselves into, such as the one that leads us to think that moral claims are claims about the nature of the world, and not just expressions of our own emotions. And this depends on paying close attention to the way we use words. Hence comes the so-called linguistic term in Anglo-American philosophy. The fictional George Moore, the real George Moore, the playwright Tom Stoppard, the play's audience, and most academic philosophers at the time were uncomfortable with Eyre's analysis. It seemed a bit too extreme. It seemed to miss important features of political, moral, and even scientific reasoning. Nonetheless, Stoppard was right in implying that Eyre and the logical positivists had set the agenda for English, and more generally, English-speaking philosophy for more than a generation. The general view was this. One might disagree with Eyre and the other logical positivists in various respects, but one had to admit that much of what had passed for philosophy in the preceding years was just metaphysical nonsense. Elaborate expressions of feeling that might be mistaken for serious accounts of the world or the human condition, but that really just masqueraded as such and could be shown by careful philosophical analysis to be essentially phony. From this point of view, virtually everything that had been written by continental philosophers since Kant's time was metaphysical nonsense. The notable exception was the work of the Vienna Circle, to which Eyre referred. To get clear, one had to go back, not to Kant, who was too much of a metaphysician despite himself, but to Hume. If one wanted to go further back, one went to Bacon, not to Descartes. The whole continental rationalist tradition was suspect. There was a political subtext to this. German philosophy had been predominant since the late 18th century, Kant's time. Many English thinkers had been under its spell, especially at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th. The real George Moore had grown up in this milieu. However, in the standard English view, the Germans had been entirely responsible for both of the two world wars. German aggression had been justified by appeals to Hegel and Nietzsche. Now there was another threatening regime, the Soviet one, which appealed to yet another German thinker, Marx, to legitimize itself. If one went looking for metaphysical nonsense, one would find a lot of it in the work of Hegel, Marx, and Nietzsche. Arguments that depended on subtle shifts of meaning, easily exposed by careful linguistic analysis. Claims about the pattern of history or human nature that could never be verified. Calls to extreme action based on purely emotional appeals. And a huge accumulation of pseudoscientific statements and inferences based on scant evidence that any sensible scholar would be bound to reject. Contemporary thinkers like the ex-Nazis, Martin Heidegger and Carl Schmitt, and communist fellow travelers like Jean-Paul Sartre and Henri Lefebvre, We're living proof of the dangers of mystical metaphysical thinking. Continental bombast might be appealing to the young, but British common sense was closer to the truth. That was what won the war. Both wars, in fact. And that was what sustained the struggle against Soviet tyranny. Moreover, that was what sustained people everywhere in moments of moral crisis. The common decency that prevented a person from betraying a friend, acting cruelly, or persecuting others just because they were different. On this view, British empiricism and the sort of modest philosophical endeavors associated with it were actually the bulwarks of reason and moral common sense. The continental rationalists in France and Germany had provided a cover for extreme brutality by framing their ideas in obscure terms that could easily be appropriated by a Hitler or a Stalin. Note the parallels. The received view in Britain, and to a large extent in the rest of the English-speaking world, was that an essentially agnostic philosophical tradition, one that, at the extreme, treated moral and political judgments as mere expressions of our emotions, and that in any case denied that such judgments could be verified by any rational process. And moreover, one that treated all statements about the world as tentative hypotheses, subject to ongoing examination and disproof in light of the evidence, was actually the only ground available to those who wanted to root the common moral decencies and common sense judgments about the facticity of the world in something stable. The stability was given not by philosophy, which could do nothing by way of offering proofs about the way we should think about the most important things, but by our everyday experience of the world, which suggested to us how we had to deal with other people and handle the many practical difficulties of life. This view is implicit in the whole philosophical tradition that derives from him. It is in Ayer's work, and indeed in the work of all the Oxford and Cambridge philosophers of his time. It is certainly there in Stoppard's play, a play that has had two major revivals in London's West End, the equivalent of Broadway, most recently in 2004. Evidently, the play still resonates with its audiences. Now, why is this relevant to understanding Foucault's legacy? Foucault does not appear either directly or indirectly as a figure in Stoppard's play. If audience members at the time, 1972, had had to name a contemporary French philosopher, most of them would have referred to Sartre. Some might have mentioned Louis Althusser. Few would have thought of Foucault. Nevertheless, Foucault's work had begun to appear in English, and it was attracting considerable notice. Madison Civilization was published in 1965, The Order of Things in 1971, The Archaeology of Knowledge in 1972, The Birth of the Clinic in 1973. By the early 1970s, Foucault had become required reading amongst Anglophone intellectuals of a critical bent. So, how was he read? I cannot give a complete answer to this question, perhaps someone could. But I want to suggest that the ways in which Foucault was read and misread in the years after his first reception in the English-speaking world had a lot to do with the revival of two streams of thought that seemed to challenge the intellectual agnosticism to which Stoppard refers in his play. Both these streams of thought were continental in origin. One was Kantian ethics, and the other, Marxian political economy. Foucault was and is read as an opponent of both. And hence, perhaps despite himself, as a supporter of the agnosticism that motivates British empiricism, and the rather modest incrementalist politics associated with it. Let me explain. In 1971, a year before Stoppard's play was first performed, John Rawls' The Theory of Justice appeared. It was framed as a neo-Kantian challenge to the orthodoxies of Humean and Benthamite utilitarianism. More than that, it was posed as a challenge to the idea that a first-order theory of justice could not be derived philosophically. What excited people about Rawls' book is that it actually advanced a substantive theory of justice and offered a 500-page philosophic defense of that theory. No important philosopher in the English-speaking world had attempted to do such a thing for more than 40 years. For the reasons Eyre and others set out. After all, who wants to be accused of writing metaphysical nonsense? Rawls raved the accusations, and many people admired his courage in that respect. Although the British recalled Rawls, nice try, John, but really, this sort of argument just doesn't work. It can't be made to work. Even if it does just confirm the commonplace moral and political judgments of decent middle-class liberals and social democrats. The Americans took to him readily. They began to generate a whole series of books in response to him. Rawls thus paved the way for Jürgen Habermas, who offered a different way of grounding moral assumptions. Soon there were at least two major schools of thought in the English-speaking world, Rawlsian and Habermasian, both of which were essentially Kantian, both of which purported to have the means of grounding what appeared like ungroundable moral and political assumptions, and both of which referred back to big, meaty books that were written by philosophers who were still very much alive and responding to their critics. This would have been unimaginable to the George Moore of Stoppard's play. The very sort of throwback to an earlier era in English-speaking moral philosophy that he would have wanted. The other important intellectual development in the English-speaking world, which began a little bit earlier, was the revival of Marxist thought in a new, more critical vein. Marx's early manuscripts finally appeared in full English translation in 1965. Thanks mainly to Herbert Marcuse, there was a burst of interest in the German critical theorists, including Adorno and Horkheimer. People began looking seriously at the work of Antonio Gramsci, the Italian communist leader who died in one of Mussolini's prisons. The Hungarian communist, Kurt Lukács, also became a figure of interest, thanks mainly to his work from the 1920s. And of course, people began reading the French Marxists, especially Louis Althusser and his Greek follower, Nicolas Polanski. I should say that Polanski loomed much larger in my mind than Foucault when I was a graduate student back in 1972, and I think I was typical in this respect. Although Marxist thinkers put ethics aside on the grounds that ethical judgments were inevitably ideological, not nonsense, no, but ideological. They positioned themselves with the proletariat politically, and hence on one side of what they took to be a world historical political struggle. To adopt the standpoint of the proletariat, to use the Lukácsian term, was to commit oneself in a particular way, and that commitment depended on a reading of history and contemporary political economy that cut against the grain of British and American common sense. It put into question a number of standard judgments, all of which were rooted in the skeptical empiricist philosophy to which Stoppard was referring. That there was no particular pattern to history, and certainly no single factor that could explain what we could observe. that the best way of dealing with differences between people was to treat those differences as preferences, and to use the market and market-like mechanisms in ways that would aggregate preferences and partial, and that the unjustifiable inequalities and unfreedoms that still marred our relationships could be eliminated gradually without overthrowing any of our major institutions. Marxism pointed toward even more bracing political commitments than the ones that seemed to follow from the neo-Kantian ethics of Rawls and Habermas. Given these developments, how did Foucault get read in the English-speaking world? Clearly, he was neither a Kantian nor a Marxist in any ordinary sense of either term. You certainly wouldn't go to Foucault to ground Kantian ethics or Marxian political economy. In fact, if you read him from a neo-Kantian or neo-Marxist perspective, you would get quite annoyed. Since Foucault undercuts many of the assumptions that you need to get Kantian ethics or Marxian political economy going, Foucault seems to push us back into the stalemate that Stoppard had represented. Like A.J. Ayer or David Hume or any number of Anglo-American thinkers, he seems to take us to the point where we can only say, clearly, there is no such thing as absolute truth. All of our judgments, both scientific and moral, are somewhat arbitrary. So where do we go from here? One obvious place to go, although this is rarely stated explicitly, is back to old-fashioned British common sense. If there aren't any ultimate grounds for our judgments, why not stick with the ones we already have? Unless there is some pretty clear evidence that we are going in the wrong direction. This is hardly a recipe for political radicalism of any sort, be it Marxist class struggle or Kantian idealism. So, Foucault makes many self-styled political radicals uneasy. And this uneasiness extends to the whole group of French thinkers with whom Foucault came to be identified, the so-called postmodernists. English-speaking Marxists like Terry Eagleton and David Harvey are particularly venomous in attacking this group because they see them as heretics who are undermining the very possibility of an intellectually robust Marxism in the English-speaking world. The fact that the post-war French thinkers came out of a predominantly Marxist intellectual milieu and so knew their Marx well and had thought hard about his ideas and the ideas of the later Marxists made these thinkers particularly maddening Anglophone Marxists who have been struggling hard to keep up, to get up to speed in this way of thinking. And we're now confronted with a bunch of ex-Marxists who had already assimilated Marxist thought and moved on from there to other things. Foucault is a brilliant example of this. He assumes, and I think this is really important for students to recognize, he assumes that you know the Marxian Hegelian and the Marxian structuralist account of things. They don't interest you much because they fail to address so many other interesting questions. What for him has to be addressed is elsewhere. We've already thought those things and worked through their implications. What else do we need to know? He just bypasses a body of thought that critical intellectuals in the English-speaking world had finally rediscovered, and then offers us what in return? some reflections on prisons and lunatics and asylums. A lot of nonsense about sex. What else? Where is the politics? In the English-speaking world, Foucault appears unradical in another, less political sense. He seems to be repeating, in some cases greatly exaggerating, ideas that were already in circulation in the English-speaking world at the time that he wrote. Perhaps they were new to the French, who seemed to pay little attention to what was going on outside France. But they were not new to sophisticated English and American readers. Take the Foucauldian notion of the episteme, for instance. 3 years before Foucault's first book appeared in English, Thomas Kuhn had published a little book on the structure of scientific revolutions, which introduced the notion of a paradigm. Now, a paradigm is not the same thing as an episteme, but there is an obvious family resemblance between the two. A Kuhnian might say that Kuhn's notion of a paradigm of scientific practice is actually more useful than the Foucauldian concept of an episteme, precisely because it is more fluid and can be used to capture the subtle shifts and changes in our knowledge practices. Foucault, it might be said, ropes the episteme to his peculiar interpretation of French intellectual history. Kuhn is more open. So why not use Kuhn rather than Foucault if we want to think about these things more clearly? One could, I think, go on with a number of other examples. Parallels to Foucault's thought in already existing Anglo-American. From an Anglo-Saxon perspective, what Foucault does is to frame his insights, real as they are, in oracular terms and pitch them in a way that they're not really subject to verification. So, although he has some of the virtues of a British empiricist, in that he breaks from Marx's dogmas, and stops trying to reduce everything to some sort of monocausal explanation, he retains what seems like, from an Anglo-Saxon perspective, many of the bad habits of the French and German metaphysicians. He plays fast and loose with his terms, makes grand generalizations ill-supported by the evidence, cites his sources very selectively, ignores rival accounts of the same matters, asserts his theories rather than arguing for them, and makes claims that just seem to come out of nowhere, with no reference to the supporting evidence and no logical argumentation. In fact, Foucault, like most of the celebrated French thinkers, does things that Anglo-Saxon professors take great care to tell their students never to do. Don't make grand claims that you can't support. Don't go beyond your evidence. Be clear about what you're saying. And don't just play with words to create a sentence and meaning. And yet, we're talking about him here, because we sense that he is an immensely important thinker. The rest of us, I can say this with some confidence, I think, will be long forgotten when Foucault is still being read. Why? Now that's a question I find much more difficult to answer, and I won't really attempt it here. I do find Foucault's work revelatory in a way that I don't find other more easily understandable work. I get Kuhn quite easily, but I'm not sure that I get. It pushes me beyond my own understanding. So for a workaday thinker like me, trained to think like a British empiricist, Foucault is an ongoing challenge and incitement to think harder and more clearly. He tells me that neither Kantian ethics nor Marxian political economy can be grounded in the way that their proponents believe. Ayer was right about that. On the other hand, it also challenges British and American common sense. He doesn't encourage me to be comfortable in the world in the way that the Anglo-American philosophers tend to do. His oddities and eccentricities, his leaps of the imagination, his grand intellectual gestures, all the things that vex and intrigue a thinker like me, push me beyond the common sense view of things and enable me to see something different. I suspect that that, rather than any particular idea or doctrine that we may associate with, is what will continue to encourage people to read Foucault in coming years. He may not be as funny as Stoppard in the way that he represents our philosophical dilemmas, but he does offer us many tools for thinking and an ongoing example of what is involved in responding creatively to the limits of